this idea that if only I had a lot more time, then surely I would be happier. And a lot of people do feel that way. They're like, oh, these ideas, like, oh, if only I had more hours in the day, right? But we studied that. We looked at what's the relationship between the amount of discretionary time people have and their happiness. And we looked at data from the American Time Use Survey. So it's tens of thousands of working and non-working Americans. And we could like capture how and or see through their reporting of how they spent their day, relate how much time they spend on discretionary activities, those things that people want to do with their satisfaction with life. And what we found was this inverted U-shape, which you alluded to, where yes, people with too little time were less happy because you saw these increased feelings of stress. But we also saw those with too much time in this data set, those with more than approximately 5 hours of discretionary time in the day were also less happy.
This episode is brought to you by Pause, Breathe, Reflect, the app that can help bring more mindfulness to your everyday moments. Imagine what would be possible if more people could live more mindfully. Hey there, my fellow like-hearted humans. It's Michael, and this is the Kintsugi Podcast. So, you want to be happy, do you? Who doesn't? Here in the States, it's all about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Heck, if you went to Amazon and did a search, you would find over 60,000 titles or books on the topic of happiness. It seems like happiness is all around us, but we're still having trouble experiencing it. Here's my take. I think many people realize that the old definition of happiness, that is all focused on how much stuff we have, hasn't been working. But boy, is that hard to let go of. We know some things we can do to make us happy today, but we still struggle. This is why I'm so excited to share this week's episode with you. I sit down with Dr. Casey Holmes from UCLA. Her research on happiness helps us go upstream so we can focus in on that precious resource that we can't produce any more of. That is time. You'll hear from our conversation how essential it is to set our intentions. Basically, how do we want to use our time? And then the importance of paying attention as we do. And if you're already part of our Pause, Breathe, Reflect community, you know this is the case for us because each Monday we start the week off setting our intentions and making a commitment to pay attention to how we're showing up so we can be happier. So if you're ready to be happier yourself, let's take a full breath in and a nice releasing breath out and get ready to learn how to be happier through the wisdom and research of Dr. Casey Holmes. Hey, Dr. Holmes, good to see you.
Wonderful. Welcome. To see you, Michael.
I can't wait for this. I know you've been asked a lot of questions around happiness. We'll get into it. But I do have a few questions. I don't think anyone has asked you. So we're going to start with one of them. So your book is called Happier Hour. So the question I have for you, do you know the song by the House Martins, Happy Hour?
I don't.
Oh, you have to. So after we get done, you got to go to Spotify or wherever you stream your music and look up the House Martins. And okay. The song Happy Hour, that could be your official song for the book. Although it doesn't really match perfectly. It's more of the happy hour in the original sense as we think it. But when I saw your book title, I was like, oh, that song. And I love that song because I'm a huge House Martins fan.
Well, thank you for the recommendation. I look forward to listening.
And with all the interviews you've been on, I now know that you've never been asked that question.
It's true.
So this is it. So we're starting off gangbusters. Strong.
I mean.
Coming strong to the mic. Here we are. All right. So here on Kintsugi, one of our traditions is to ask people, how'd you meet your partner? So there's a lot of love in your book for your husband, Rob. So I need to ask, how did you and Rob meet?
Yeah. Which it makes, like, brings a smile to my face because there is so much goodness in my life with Rob. And thinking back to those initial moments when we met, we were set up on a blind date by a mutual friend of ours. And this was coming out of a very unhappy relationship where I was planning to get married and 2 weeks away from the Humongo wedding when my fiance at the time decided that he wasn't quite ready to get married. So it was quite devastating. And I talk about this in the book as how, while I, you know, I'm an expert in heaviness, a lot of it sort of comes down to choices we make and despite some events that come our way. But so on the heels of that, once I sort of got through my anger and depression, one of my friends was like, you know, I have this guy I think you should meet. And I'm like, no, I'm not into dating right now. And she's like, no. And so we met up for coffee. We were both at grad school at Stanford. And so there's a Rodin sculpture garden on campus. So I sort of reluctantly met up for coffee. And it was so great because he's such a wonderful conversationalist. And I talk about in the book the importance of connection, like true social connection, and how that can come from conversation that digs a level deeper than just the sort of superficial, like, what's your name? What do you do? You know, what are your hobbies? To really, like, who are you? What are your emotional experiences in life? What are your passions? What are your fears? What are your hopes? And Rob taking everything he does very, like, to the nth degree. He was taking this course at Stanford's business school called, the nickname of it was touchy-feely, but it's basically like interpersonal dynamics. So while he is very analytical in taking this course, he's like all about interpersonal dynamics. So he shows up at this coffee date and he was like asking, what are your hopes? What are your fears in life? And I'm like, oh.
But he's asking you some big questions on the first date. Holy
totally.
Cow.
Totally. And it was such a breath of fresh air by going deep. It was like this lightness that comes from genuine connection that came from conversation. And that's still our like source of connection in our marriage is those like wonderful deep conversations about our hopes and fears. Along with the logistics, right?
Absolutely. That's what we do as married people, like hopes and dreams and fears and what's for dinner? Like, and who's doing the pickup? And so at times we feel like two ships passing in the middle of the night, but when we have connection time, that's a really, it can be a really happy time. I know it is for me. Like I cherish our dog walks, my wife and I, because it's just our time to be a couple because it's so easy with kids, as you know, not to feel like a couple sometimes because we're trying to manage a household. It feels like we're running a company as opposed to really living a life. So I love that. We got set up and hopefully the person who set you up got invited to the wedding.
Well, actually we had this like little group, like elopement. So we didn't really have a wedding.
Oh.
Gosh, we have thanked her many, many times.
Yeah, she's definitely on the holiday greeting card list
this
year. Yeah, absolutely. So let's go back a little bit. How did you get into happiness? So I've, you know, meeting you now and seeing the content and reading your book, my hunch is that
if I met you in high school, you'd be Cassie's the happy girl, with a good disposition and cheerful and optimistic and hopeful. But how did you get into pursuing a career in happiness?
Yeah. And in high school, you are correct. I was probably would be described as the happy one. And I still am. Like, I think I am described. Yes. So that I do have a natural disposition. But, and actually research when looking at what are the inputs into happiness, one's natural disposition is a big factor and perhaps one of the biggest. But there are other things that come into play, right? There are those events that happen in life, like I just shared, getting sort of like basically at the altar, the love of my life. So I thought at the time, that was quite devastating. There are also, you know, other sort of events in my life that perhaps, not perhaps, that objectively were not happy. And so seeing how one reacts to and responds to those events, I was sort of motivated to figure out, okay, what are things that we can do if someone isn't sort of lucky enough to have a natural disposition towards happiness, or when, not if, when those negative events happen, what are things that we can do to sort of make us feel good in our days and satisfied about our lives. And I was motivated actually as I'm a social psychology undergrad major. And then in my PhD, I was interested in sort of person dynamics, right? Like, what are the factors that make us make particular decisions, make us feel motivated? And my PhD was at a business school. I was at Stanford's business school in a marketing PhD. And so I was looking at, you know, what are the factors of when you present options to someone that makes them feel satisfied with their choices? As a marketing PhD, I was looking at choices of magazine or choice of coffee. And then I was like, hold on, what I really care about is people's choices about that affect them overall in life, not just their satisfaction with their coffee brand, but really their satisfaction with their life in general. And recognizing also at a business school where there's a lot of focus on money, I was like, well, the resource that really seems to matter for happiness and satisfaction with the choices we make is time. And so it was during my PhD that I was like, what I want to do is figure out what are decisions that we can make so that we feel satisfied in and about our lives, recognizing the value and the role that time plays, so that everyone can feel as positive in and about their lives as me, as well as despite particular events, all of us have the tools sort of available so that when we're making those decisions of how do we spend our time, what should we do to feel better, they're actually empirically informed. So I guess my drive towards happiness is I want more people to feel like me on my best day.
I am down for that. That is music to my ears. And as you mentioned, so I call that day of my accident my last bad day. And it's really an acknowledgement that we have a whole bunch of moments in our day. And since my accident, I've had plenty of bad moments, but I don't have to give them any more fuel than they deserve. You know, we take it's a mountain out of a molehill type of thing. So things happen, big things happen, like my accident and your wedding that never occurred, right? And so those are devastating. We feel a lot of emotions. And there's a whole bunch of other lesser bad moments, if you will. And there are things that we can tap into so it doesn't turn out to be bigger than it needs to. And before my accident, I was pretty much a typical person, believing that my happiness was going to be found in all the stuff, probably much like the MBAs that you teach today. that I'm going to get this big job. I'll get into venture capital, like maybe for those out at UCLA, but I'll have a big title, a nice office, a good car and all that jazz. And I'll be happy. You know, the chasing of happiness, as Thomas Jefferson once wrote, the pursuit of happiness, which he really didn't mean that, as we know, but we're not going to go there. I finally realized that it was all about time. And so when I found your book, and really your position is like, we have to look at time as a driver of happiness. And what I found to be interesting was that there was actually a sweet spot. So if you ask a lot of people, if you said, well, what's going to help you with happiness? They need more time. So we're sort of time poor, but there's also the other side of it. It's like having too much time doesn't necessarily make us happy either. And I would love for you to share more about this sweet spot when it comes to time in relationship to happiness.
Yeah. And I'm glad you asked, because I mean, talking about another sort of motivator in the work that I do, is figuring out, like, okay, happiness. So we want to feel good in and about our days. But I found that for myself, time was one of the biggest barriers, right? So that sense of time poverty, of having just too much to do and not enough time to do it. And this is an experienced by many, many people in our country, in the world, not by everyone, but those of us who do feel it, and I felt it very acutely, particularly earlier in my career, and I actually still feel it now. I like have to work hard to combat it. It's like when you're working full time, you have a partner who works full time, you have kids that you're sort of managing their lives and schedules. You are also trying to be healthy. So where do you, you know, fit in exercise? And you're also trying to sort of not just sort of get by in your career, but really sort of succeed at it. So it's like, and these like, you know, super mundane chores that we are perpetually sort of faced with. And in a sort of moment earlier in my career when I was an assistant professor, I was like, I don't know if this is even possible, right? Like something's got to give. Is it my career? Is it that I'm just going to be a negligent mom that's not involved at all? Is it maybe my relationship with my partner? Is it like, we'll not have friends because I don't have time to like meet up with anyone ever? And I thought that something had to give with this idea that if only I had a lot more time, then surely I would be happier. And a lot of people do feel that way. They're like, oh, these ideas, like, oh, if only I had more hours in the day, right? But we studied that. We looked at what's the relationship between the amount of discretionary time people have and their happiness. And we looked at data from the American Time Use Survey. So it's tens of thousands of working and non-working Americans. And we could like capture how and or see through their reporting of how they spent their day, relate how much time they spend on discretionary activities, those things that people want to do, with their satisfaction with life. And what we found was this inverted U-shape, which you alluded to, where yes, people with too little time were less happy because you saw these increased feelings of stress. But we also saw those with too much time in this data set, those with more than approximately 5 hours of discretionary time in the day were also less happy. And that was driven by something else. That was driven by a sense of not feeling productive, not having a sense of purpose. And with that, it undermines people's satisfaction and happiness. And so that sweet spot, it's actually pretty wide. It's, we found that between approximately 2 and 5 hours of discretionary time in the day, there was no relationship actually between how much time people had and their happiness. And actually I will say there's like a lot of noise in the data more generally. And so both with respect to the sweet spot, you need some time in the day to spend on what matters to you or what you feel like you want to be doing. But you also need some time that is like required of whatever that pursuit that it is, not having all the hours of your day just relaxing on the beach, because there is such thing as sort of the too much time effect was really driven by not discretionary time per se, but discretionary time spent relaxing and not in these ways that are fulfilling and feel worthwhile. But also, because there is so much noise in the data, I think that's even more important, is that it's actually, for happiness, it's not how much time you have available. It's really a question of how you spend that time. And that is really a question of not only the particular activities that you're spending your time on, carving out and protecting time for those things that really matter to you, and minimizing the time on what feels like a waste or a drain. But also when you're spending that time, and this is so related to your work, of paying attention, you know, of like, even if you're doing an activity that you love, if you're on your phone, your mind is somewhere else, you're like in your head planning for, you know, all the things that you're stressed about next week, then you might as well not be spending time on that activity because you're not even there. You're missing out on it. So all of this is to say that while, you know, for happiness, I initially thought that that time was that big challenge, if not having enough, actually it can truly be the solution, because if you become more intentional on the activities, but also intentional in paying attention when you're spending time on those really wonderful activities, then you get the satisfaction and the energy and the boost and all the good stuff.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing that you just shared, and I picked up on it in your TEDx talk. And as you mentioned, as a meditation teacher, what I do each Monday morning is I lead a group live practice on Zoom around intention setting. And basically, how do we want to show up today? How do we want to show up for the week? Basically, the type of ripple that we want to put into the world, but are we aligning our activities around our first principles or the values that we cherish? You know, doing stuff that's meaningful and to the point of awareness. So we're going to have moments in our day where we venture off course. Because the unexpected happens. Like, we plan out the beautiful day, we plan out the beautiful week, and then we get a curveball. And that's when we want to pay attention to, okay, what are we spending our time on now? And maybe come back to that intention. So I love that you just shared that. On the side of like too much time, and I'm not sure if the data is too noisy to tease this out, was there any type of association to age? You know, for example, as people go through their career, they have a purpose, if you will, a reason to get up. The Japanese would call that the ikigai, reason to get up in the morning, right? And they might complain about how busy they are and they don't have time doing the job. But then they go into retirement and they haven't really found that reason to get up or a sense of purpose. So did you see any type of correlation with age and happiness around that aspect of having too much time?
Yeah, it's a great question, because folks who have retired are sort of particularly subject to that, or prone to that too much time effect. But what's really important to recognize is that this sort of inverted U-shape is not influenced by age. That is, irrespective of how old you are, there is such thing as having too little time and too much time. So there are sort of people who are not retired who actually fall in the too much time bucket, for it can be other reasons than they have left their, like, you know, retired from their entire career. But what's also interesting is among those who have retired in that age group, you see that not everybody feels that they have too much time. Those who spend time on these activities that they are not paid work, but perhaps it's volunteer work, perhaps it is developing that enriching hobby, it is exercise. And we see that when people are spending, and social connection actually, to the point of this, is a really big one. Among retirees, when they are spending some time in their week on these activities that make them feel productive, that give them a sense of purpose, that make them realize that they're still having contributing to those around them, but also are growing by, you know, in those hobbies where they're learning something new, and they feel the responsibility of that and the sense of reward from that. So yes, it's something, the too much time effect is sort of a cautionary tale among those who are eager to retire with this sense of like, oh my gosh, then I'll have all the day to relax and play golf and, you know, sit on the beach.
And go to Del Boca Vista and we'll have pina coladas and, you know, yeah, all that, you know. But then after a while, that gets a little dull.
It gets dull, and that's where you get the too much time effect. But yeah, if you say move and go and, you know, start volunteering somewhere or join a bridge team and learn how to play bridge, then all of a sudden there are these ways of spending that aren't just relaxing and doing nothing, but give you a sense of productivity and purpose. And so it's being intentional, again, going back to when you then are retired, being intentional about, all right, what are those activities that you're going to bring into your life to make sure that you continue to have things that give you a sense of productivity and purpose.
And community, yeah.
And community. So, oh, yes. Because also, importantly, we did not see, so we looked at, in our data, those who had the discretionary time. And when we saw, we looked at whether those discretionary activities involved social connection, you actually didn't see this drop off. That is, like, they didn't see the too much time effect. That is, if you're spending time, your discretionary time connecting with others, then there's a sort of continued effect, positive effect of those investments and relationships.
So that correlates pretty well with Harvard's study, the longitudinal study, yeah, around happiness, because they point to social connection as a big driver to happiness. And then, yes, even Dan Buettner's work around blue zones and living to 100, if that's the desire, with a good long lifespan, but also a health span, he also sort of pointed to the need for community. Mm-hmm. And in a very like fast paced world that we live in, where we feel connected but not connected, really more disconnected, we're not really spending time developing our relationships like we could. And so I think one of the takeaways from your book is, if we're not there yet, maybe that's something to take action on as we go through whatever phase of life we're in. And it comes in phases. Like if we're young parents, it might be a little bit more difficult to have that time for friend connections, but to be at least aware of the need to have these connections as we go through other phases of our life.
Yeah. And even as you were saying, it's like you're now, I don't know if it was always in this form, but your dog walks with your wife, it's like even in those times where you feel like there isn't any room for cultivating relationships, even with your partner, let alone friends who are outside of the house, recognizing the importance of doing so. Because even though you feel like you don't have the time, when you do spend the time, it can like re-energize and give you that that sort of sense that things will be okay.
And we're going to be okay here. We're gonna yeah, be able to figure this out. And there are like-hearted humans around us, and it's not, yeah, the world's not going to hell in a handbasket, right? So yeah, because on our walks, we'll run into our neighbors, we'll run into our friends, and it's a brief encounter. If they're also walking their dogs, we're half the battle is trying to keep our dogs away from each other. But we do a little chit chat and have a connection. Maybe it's not in depth, but it's still there, and it feels like we're building community. So, so I love that you brought that up. So around intention, my hunch is that people really don't know what they're spending their time on. Mm-hmm. We talk about, I don't have enough time, and you ask, well, how much time are you spending on X, Y, or Z? And I don't think people really know. You know, as an executive coach, I ask a question sort of similar to this to my clients. You have a worksheet, so I printed off the worksheet, so in my color-coded way, a little show and tell. So
yeah.
So can you tell tell more, yeah. share more about this timesheet that you have on your website. I'll put the link in the show notes because it's a podcast and a podcast has to have show notes, right? So we'll put it there so people can download it. But if you could add some commentary to how someone should use this and how it can be helpful in understanding how rich they are when it comes to time.
Yeah. And I'm so glad you brought that up because I was actually going to mention it in when we were just talking about the role of social connection. Not only do people not know how they're spending their time, people aren't very good at knowing which ways of spending their time are actually satisfying and are actually fulfilling. So we have this sense of like, oh, these are the things that I enjoy doing. But is it true? You know, sometimes we're actually pretty bad at being, we're like, oh, like that we have the sense that we really enjoy, you know, watching TV. But then you like, look, like having watched TV for a couple of hours, like coming out of it, how do you actually feel? And so what the time tracker is, it's so simple. It's actually tedious to do, but the idea is simple. And it is, once you get going, it's like you can execute on it, but it is so worthwhile. So what it is over the course of a week, for each about half hour, writing down what activity you did. And as importantly, rating, coming out of that activity on a 10-point scale, how do you feel? How satisfied, fulfilled, you know, overall positivity, how did you feel from that activity? And again, it's not, in general, what activities do you enjoy doing? It's having just done something, how do you feel? And then you have, over the course of the week, you had your color coding, which I think was also capturing not only the activity, but probably the emotion.
Yeah, each color represents something I was doing. Yeah. And I knew I was going to share it, so I didn't really want to give my whole life away on the internet as far as everything I was doing. But yeah, there is a system there that I can read and probably only I can read.
But as long as you can read it, because that's the purpose of it, is at the end of the week, you can look at your own data and look, okay, across the weeks, what are those activities that brought you, that got your highest ratings? What are those activities that were getting the 8s, 9s, 10s, and writing them down? And what are those activities that actually got your lowest ratings? Writing them down. And then also looking among your most positive activities, what are some commonalities across them? And so that allows you to pull out sort of sources of joy. For many, it's like pulling out not only social connection, it's like, oh gosh, you know, it's like the example that I have shared because it is so true. And I keep reminding myself when I like find myself coming out of a social situation, I'm like, why didn't that feel as fun as it should have? I'm like, oh, because I learned from my time tracking that I really value one-on-one time, one-on-one conversation. Actually, going back to my, you know, coffee date with Rob.
That was like your jam. I was like, oh my God, this is awesome.
Totally. Yeah. Thank gosh we didn't meet at a cocktail party. That would have been
like small talk. Yeah, that would have been awkward. Yeah.
And so I know for me, it is that one-on-one time. And whether it's in a social context, a family context, or even in a worked context, that's really satisfying for me. Whereas in bigger groups, I actually, for me personally, and this isn't what data is showing in general, so don't have people think like, oh, one-on-one time is better for everyone. I learned from my own time tracking that's better for me. But folks doing the time tracking will learn for themselves what are those ways of spending that are really fulfilling. And then that can be helpful because then as you're, you know, designing upcoming time of protecting time in our busy lives for those activities that really matter. Also, there's some surprises. Like I've had now hundreds of students do this assignment over the years and sort of hearing the consistency in some of their reflections of like, you know, this sense of like, oh, watching TV, you know, is my fun activity. But then they see in their ratings that first half hour and maybe even hour is really fun, but hour 3-4 into the binge, they actually start feeling pretty crummy. Or social media, it's like, oh, social media is my fun, you know, like relax time. But actually, then they see how they felt coming out and they're like, Wow.
Yeah, this doesn't make me feel good at all. I feel like crap. Right. Yeah, just like.
Holy cow, how much time were they actually spending? So in addition to seeing the satisfaction you feel from your activities, you realize just how much time you're spending on various activities. And in some cases, it's like a rude awakening of like, oh my gosh, I spend so much time on X. It's not necessary. It doesn't bring me joy. Why am I doing it? Especially when I feel so busy, right? So that's helpful. And it also, you can sort of see what are those activities that are true drains and sort of identifying what are some features of that so that then you can use other strategies to, well, either maybe say no to those activities if you have some volition over it. Or if you do have to do it, is there a way that you can structure it, whether bundling with something more enjoyable, putting something enjoyable right after it so that it doesn't like continue to ruin the rest of your day or week. So you can use some other strategies to offset that negative impact of those obligatory, not so fun activities.
All right. Now feels like a good time to take a moment to pause, breathe, reflect. And when we come back, I'll share with Casey one of our pleasures here in our household. And she'll share how to become happier when you're at work. But before we head back into our conversation, let's take three generous breaths together. So breathe up through your nose if you can, and place your attention on the breath. Where do you feel it most clearly? And then release the breath and give yourself permission to relax into this moment. Nice full breath in. And a releasing breath out. Let's do one more of these. A nice full breath in. And a relaxing breath out. Nice job. You just took a moment to connect with your breath. A little pause, breathe, reflect opportunity. And on our app, you can find hundreds of practices that can help you become happier and live a meaningful life. All you have to do is head over to the Apple Store or Google Play and type in pause, breathe, reflect to begin to bring more mindfulness to your everyday moments. All right, let's head back to our conversation and discover that little pleasure I share with my daughters. And Dr. Holmes will share more about how to become happier at work.
Yeah, I want to get into the biggest one, work, but I will share like through my own tracker. So I'll be public. We watched The Bachelor at our house.
But
to your point, Cassie, yeah. Like when I watch it with my girls, super fun. Like it's our father-daughter bonding, totally cool. I'm no longer on X, but one of my fun things to do was to follow the show when X was known as Twitter, because I was like, people in the world are really funny. So that was, but I no longer on X, but watching it with them is so much fun. Watching it by myself, not so much fun. So for me, it's about that connection with them. And so I think that's the real value with the tracker, a couple things that you mentioned.
Yeah,
you do get to pay attention to what you're spending time on, because I think we underestimate how much time we're spending on things that don't really fulfill us. Mm-hmm. That we say, oh, we just need some downtime. It's our mind candy, but it doesn't really bring much happiness and fulfills us. We could be doing other things that do that for us. And then we have a better idea of like, okay, what brings us happiness with our time? And this gets us to work. Right. So one thing, in order to have a lifestyle, unless you are born on third base, you have to go do the job.
Yeah.
How do we make work happier?
Yeah.
And knowing that everyone's job is a little bit different and everyone's at a different stage, but do you have any general guidance on how to make work a bit happier? Because it seems like work is one of the big drainers of our happiness.
Yeah, if you look sort of averaging across time tracking research of what are those activities that tend to be associated with the most negative emotion or the least positive emotion, it is commuting, work, and housework. So work. And it is, as you said, we have to work unless we're, you know, perhaps lucky enough that actually, as we talked about the too much time effect, maybe it would be unlucky if you didn't have to work. Anyway, all to say, many of us have to work. So, but given that for so many, not only is it the least happy, but when you add up the amount of hours in our lives that we spend working, it is not something that we just want to wait through. You know, how we spend the hours of our days sum up to the years of our lives. And so it's just too much of our life to waste and sort of wait through, and it makes life overall a waste. So I am very strongly like figuring out, to your question, what are ways that we can make work not terrible and the time we spend there, and to make it potentially a source of happiness and fulfillment. Now, and also I will say that the time tracking is also helpful for this, because you'll pick up, like, as you're being more precise in what activities, it's not just work. It's like you're putting, like, I'm in a meeting, or, you know, I'm responding to emails, or I'm working on a deck. And so you can actually identify within your workday what are those activities that are actually are quite satisfying, and then also what are those activities that are sources of drain. But to answer the question, what are ways to make work more fun? Social connection. Here we go. Yes. Again. It's like the again. Answer of yeah. the, you know, the hour. And because it's not just in our lives outside of work that we can find connection and friendship even. And there's a sort of funny sounding question in Gallup poll that asks, do you have a best friend at work? And even though it sounds silly, like in something my third grader would ask, it's very predictive. So even though only 2 out of 10 Americans, working Americans, say they have a best friend at work, those who do are significantly more engaged in their work, they are more productive, and they are most satisfied with their work. And job satisfaction carries over into life satisfaction. And so with that, even of like thinking about how can you cultivate friendship in your workplace or in your workday, if you work remotely, what are ways that you can set up not just, you know, the schmoozing, but really sense of friendship?
Factor.
Pardon?
What I hear from you, Cassie, is that companies need a little bit more Rob in their culture to go.
They need more
Rob. We need more cowbell in our lives, and we need more Rob to like go. But in all seriousness, you know, maybe leaders can do this, is to go a little bit deeper in a safe way.
Yeah.
So we have stronger connections, as opposed to the transactional nature of work today. I call it the Janet Jackson effect. Like, what have you done for me lately? You know, like,
right.
But to have that more deeper connection and a chance for conversation to build those bonds.
Yeah. And to be clear, you don't have to be best friends with everyone that you work with.
Sure.
Yeah. But it is making sure that there's at least a couple of people whom you genuinely care about and you feel supported by, so that it isn't just transactional, like you said. So figuring out for yourself, how do you cultivate friendship in your workday? And sometimes that takes a little bit of, you know, going outside of your comfort zone, but it's so worth it. And it also, you know, to the sense of like, oh, you know, I have so much to do, it's not worth the time. it's absolutely worth the time, because when you spend time in these ways that feel fulfilling, it actually makes you feel like you have more time. And we have data that shows that when you give time to others and it makes you feel like you're effective with your time, then it actually makes you feel more time affluent. So connection, friendship, I should say. The other is knowing the reason, the why, the purpose of the work that you do. And so I talk about in Happier Hour in the book, these exercises, because it's based off of this course that I've developed and I've been teaching to my MBAs. And so I give them these assignments to figure out like the time tracking and other things like writing a gratitude letter, doing a digital detox, all of these things. In addition to the five whys exercise. And the five whys exercise is asking, you know, like, what's the work that you do? And then oftentimes the answer is like the job title. And then I ask, well, why do you do that? And then the answer tends to be either money or the job description. And then the question is like, well, why is that important to you? And clearly, like, money is a driver, but why is this the particular way you're spending your time in order to make money? And then once you ask yourself sort of five layers to your own answers of like, why does that matter to you? Not why does it matter in general, but why does it matter to you? It really uncovers what are the sort of, what's your intrinsic motivation? What is your, are your, in this case, sort of purpose and goals, which sort of is associated with values. But what's helpful about that is that then you can see what work activities contribute to that why. And once you know, even if the work activity isn't particularly fun, when you realize that, oh, this is so that, you know, like as the example, me as a business school professor, you know, why do I do that? Well, my job description is to do research, teach, I have service. Well, why is that important? So in answering several layers of why, creating and disseminating knowledge is the next one. And then why is that important to make people smart? Ultimately, I revealed from this exercise that my purpose is to create and disseminate knowledge about what makes people happy. Ultimately, I want to make more people happy. Now, knowing that is really helpful because, A, it can help me sort of be clear on what projects or what activities to spend time on or to sort of decline on, right? If it's in line with creating or disseminating knowledge about what makes people happy, then yes, I will do it. So joining you today on this podcast is about disseminating knowledge about what makes people happy. Yes, that's worthwhile. And this is fun. But when I'm like looking at my email, which does not bring me joy, if I'm like, okay, actually responding to a student, like, oh, that's not really email. That's about disseminating knowledge about what makes people happy. If I'm responding to a research collaborator, it's not really email. It's really about creating knowledge about what makes people happy. And so knowing what drives you and what your why is, it makes, not only helps you filter what to spend time on, but it makes some of those onerous work tasks feel better because you know there's a point to it. And so identifying for yourself what's your purpose, identifying, and actually this is going back to in the work context, really managers and leaders should do a better job of articulating what the purpose is for the work that they're doing, and maybe even articulating to the person you're asking to do something of like, the reason you're doing this is it contributes to this like higher order thing. And then it's like, okay, even though it might not be fun, it is worth it. And therefore it feels more fun. So between social connection and identifying purpose, those are ways to make work more fun.
Awesome. So that's a question I ask a lot of the leaders I coach, to work with their team members around their own personal why. Mm-hmm. In some ways, their relationship with money, because the money thing comes up. Like, because status, no. They want to be paid fairly, no doubt.
Yeah.
There needs to be equity in the system, which we don't have yet, but we're working towards it. But it's that relationship with money. What does the money mean to you? Which can get to the why. Like, why are you doing this?
Yeah.
And I think it was Viktor Frankl who I think originally said it, like, the bigger the why, the easier the how. So the big why helps us get through those like difficult, muddy moments in life. So when we're doing the stuff that's meh and work, we can go back to our why and remember that to get through that. So you've been teaching this course to MBA students and executive MBA students. And with our society, there's been a lot of attention around happiness, a lot of books, podcasts, apps around happiness. Have you seen your students approaching happiness differently over the years? Because they're coming into an excellent MBA program at UCLA. I'm sure many of them are highly competitive. There's Stanford, as you've mentioned, that you went to just up the street. There's USC. So there's this competition for those high-paying jobs. So I imagine they're coming in with this sort of old definition of happiness that it's in the status. Their status will make them happy. I would love for you to share, like, what have you seen from maybe a younger generation, from my perspective, around their relationship with happiness? Basically, Cassie, I'm asking you to give me some hope that the younger generation sees this differently. There's some optimism in here that we're going to start changing how we view things.
Yeah. I don't know if it will give you hope, but it has certainly changed. And I feel hopeful in interacting with my students. I think there is a lot of potential or reason for optimism. But it's interesting, and it's a great question, because even happiness, not just my students, but in a business school, has changed dramatically. When I joined UCLA 7 years ago, now it's almost 8, but after a couple of years, I like went and I was like, I want to develop and start teaching a course on happiness, because I'd been researching happiness my whole career, but I had been teaching traditional marketing courses. And like, enough is enough. My time matters to me. I want to do what fulfills me. I want to teach happiness too. And I went and I presented this to the curriculum committee, and they were like, no. We're a business school.
It's finance and accounting, Cassie, not happiness. They can be happy once they retire.
Totally. Like, what place is there for happiness at a business school? And then I'm like, wouldn't take no for an answer. So I came back to them with all the data that points to when employees feel happier, they are more engaged, better, more productive, better performers. And that translates into the bottom line. And you see with recruitment, retention, the happiness of your employees does matter from a financial perspective. But also, here we are educating our students to not just get the job, but to really succeed throughout their careers. And not only, you know, does job satisfaction influence happiness, but happiness translates into job, you know, like how people show up within their careers. It makes them less likely to burn out. It makes it more sustainable. It makes them likely to have a longer term impact. So I convinced them, and they're like, okay, on a trial period, we will let you teach this course. And it was so well received by students, because they're like, we need this, particularly actually the executive MBAs who are later in their careers, and they are really struggling and juggling family. It's not just about career. It is like, how does that career fit into the rest of your life so that you can actually do your career in a really meaningful and impactful way? And so they're like, we need this, the students, and it really spoke to a desire. Also, the younger, my regular MBAs, those who are in their late 20s, they are a generation that is more idealistic. They do value, purpose. They need to be told why actually what they're doing matters.
Why are we doing this? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And so their almost demands for feeling full and happy in their lives were like, this was a course that was speaking to that too. But also what I like about speaking to that set of students is telling them that it's not from out here that your satisfaction will come. It's not like, manager, you're responsible for my happiness at work. It is up to you to make decisions and to sort of take care of yourself and to show up and be clear about your purpose so that you can deliver. While I've been teaching it for 5 years, but 2 years in, the pandemic hit. Yeah. And that was a time where all of a sudden you couldn't take happiness for granted. Mental health was everyone had to care about it. In the business sector, leaders, like everyone had to face this, not only their personal well-being, but also figuring out how do we support the teams around us. And so it became not only understanding happiness in demand by the students, but is in demand as an expertise by the professional world. And so we don't take happiness for granted. I mean, that's also, I will say that the term happiness sometimes has this connotation of being light and silly, but when I'm using it, I'm really talking about emotional well-being, feeling satisfied in and about your life. And that is so important that we can't ignore it anymore, because we all went through something so terrible that it's like, we need to know what are the tools to get through it and to overcome it and then to ultimately thrive.
Yeah. And we really haven't adjudicated what we went through fully yet. I think we got through it and we're like, okay, on to normal, on to like catch up time. I don't know if the data proves this out, Cassie, and I don't want you to cross any ethical boundaries, but you could tell UCLA that when people are happier, they give bigger donations back to the university. So,
yeah. So I don't know if the data
proves that out, but that's my hunch. That's what I'm going with. Yeah. I'm going with that. That might be an opinion, not a fact. So yeah. We'll round out here. So you came out with your book, and obviously you've met with a lot of people through your book and offering this whole concept around time rather than money. But I'm curious, what have you learned since the book has come out? Like talking to so many people reaching out to you, imagine on social media, with the interviews that you've done, you put your heart and soul into writing the book, all the research and all the stories, excellent read. But I'm certain you've learned some additional things around happiness now that the book's out and you've traveled around and met a lot of people.
Yeah, it's interesting because the underlying truth or message or points that I was making hold strongly. I think the thing that I've learned is how different parts of it resonate with different people. So it's almost like hearing people from their examples of like, oh, this point about this showed up for me in this way and was so impactful. And then like someone else will be like, this part of it like really like affected me in this way and from that. And so it's actually seeing the color and the diversity in which these really sort of fundamental messages of social connection, of being intentional about where we invest ourselves, of being paying attention during those things that really matter. You know, these are things that, and actually even taking this broader view of time. And so this is some work that I've done more recently, and I talked about in the last chapter of the book, but we've sort of continued to explore it in the data, of when we think about time, while, you know, it's sort of managing the hours of our day, it's really, there's, if you sort of zoom out and think about our lives, you know, it's not about our hours. It's really about our life overall, those years. And what we have found is that when people take a broader perspective of their time, thinking about their years and life overall, and what that does is it makes people think about what matters. What are their values? What is their purpose? In one of the exercises I have my students do, and I talk about in the last chapter, is having people even write their eulogy. Like, that is something that on the face of it may not be so happy. But it is. It's leading people to think about, at the end of your life, what impact do you want to, how do you want people to remember you? And articulating that is very clarifying. And so taking that broad view of time in your life overall, you know, what do you want? When you think about your years, your next 5 years, what do you want to have accomplished, or what do you want, impact do you want to have? And that then should inform how we spend our hours today and how engaged we are during some of those hours. And so it's that has sort of crystallized for me as it's not just time, it's really the big time that should inform our hours.
I so appreciate that. I just wrote a blog post about Stoicism. The Stoics have a concept called memento mori. Basically, it's remembering that we will pass away, we will die. So it really brings attention to how do you want to live. And so what inspired the post was going back to celebrate my dad's 88th birthday. And, you know, I realized he doesn't have many birthdays left. Now, he might not like me writing about that or saying that because we have a weird relationship with the inevitable here in the West, but we all cross the same finish line. So if we can get comfortable with that, and then we can bring some attention to, like, how do we want to live? Like, what do we want to spend our time on? And I think one of the things I took away from your book that I'll underscore for those listening is that happiness is an individual formula. I know, like, in this world, I imagine you've spoken to other people who will say, hey, Dr. Holmes, what's the secret? Give us the hack. Yeah, give us that one thing that we need to do. And for me, coming away from reading your book was, we're all going through different phases of life. This formula is individual, and it will change. And so as you pay attention and set your intentions to change that formula, change the recipe, if you will, then you can continue to have happiness from the inside out throughout your life. Mm-hmm. But there is no magic pill to take, and there's no hack, and there's no shortcut. It's an individual inside out type of affair, and a lot of it depends on how you want to spend your time. So yeah. I'm so psyched that we got to connect, and I'll finally ask, is there anything I didn't ask you but should have asked you about happiness?
No, I think it was, I mean, there's a lot we could talk about, but we covered the important stuff, and it was very, a source of joy and fulfillment, our time together. So thank you.
You're welcome. And be sure to check out the House Martins after we get done.
I wrote it down.
You and Rob can dance to it. So, so many thanks. It was a happier hour. So,
indeed.
So thanks for joining.
Thanks.
Isn't Dr. Holmes fantastic? Just being in her company made me feel happier. And I would definitely recommend going to her website, and I'll put the link in the show notes, because after all, this is a podcast and I'm required to have show notes. While you're on her website, you can download her time tracker so you can get a better understanding on how you're spending your time. I will also include how to pick up her book, Happier Hour, as well as how to connect with her on social media. And if you do, let her know You heard her on the Kintsugi podcast. I will also share in the show notes a link to my calendar. So if you ever want to talk about how to get happier, leadership, culture, mindfulness, and how to prevent a bad moment from turning into a bad day, so grab some time because I would love to be able to support you and your company. Again, Dr. Holmes, thank you for joining us on the Kintsugi podcast. We love your energy and we're grateful for the happiness ripple you're putting into the world. And to you, I want to thank you for carving out time, your most precious resource, to join us here on the Kintsugi podcast. You make things possible here. And if you haven't already done so, I would love it if you left a kind review and rating wherever you happen to be listening to this episode. And until next week, and another conversation of connection, remember, if you meet a challenging moment, slow it down, come back to your breath, and remember that you've got this and we've got you. Together, we are going to put a beautiful ripple into the world, and we'll celebrate our scars as golden symbols of strength and resilience as we do. I love you. Thank you for listening. And I'll see you next week. This episode is brought to you by Pause, Breathe, Reflect, the app that can help bring more mindfulness to your everyday moments. Imagine what would be possible if more people could live more mindfully.